Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
Inside the Bet 365 Command Center, jQuery along with Mike Thompson, Landon Coons putting it all together for us. It is Beyond the Bricks. Brought to you, as you heard there, by Quality Supply and Tool. Our look at the history, the names, the features, the folks, the audio of the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Mike, tonight we get the pleasure, as we again are in the week of the Brickyard 400, of taking a look at those drivers who tested themselves not just in IndyCar, but in stock car as well. And we're going to start off tonight by talking about a guy that I think is one of the more fun personalities and a guy that no matter what car it was, he was going to get in it and say, my right foot is going down to the floor, and this thing's going to go as fast as possible, and a hard charger, talking about Gordon Johncock.
That's right. And he has a bit of a reputation as being kind of the grumpy old man of IndyCar racing. And he's really not that. He's a very nice guy, and he's a fun person to talk to. But, you know, he didn't do a lot of interviews and he didn't do a lot of talking. So he has kind of this, I think, again, reputation of not being approachable, but I've always thought he's one of the nicer guys. And as you said, absolute hard charger and an incredibly tough competitor.
I had the pleasure, I will interject, I guess, of meeting Gordon Johncock at his home about 3 or 4 years ago up in Michigan, where he works obviously in the lumber industry to this day. And I asked him about the fact that you just don't see him around as much as some of the other drivers. And to your point, Mike, I think kind of that stereotype of, well, he's this grumpy old man, that was not the case at all. He was extremely warm and fun and hospitable. But he just said to me, you know, look, I'm very involved in the industry that I'm in now, and I enjoyed racing and I enjoyed my competitors, but that was a job I had. And that was a job that I no longer have. And I'm on to a different point in my life. I enjoyed it. I have no ill will about it. But I have other things going on now. I thought that was a perfectly suitable answer and explanation, quite frankly, on the life of Gordon Johncock. But, of course, Gordon Johncock, and we did talk about what we'll get to later in the program, is a two-time Indianapolis 500 winner. And I think that there is some justice in the fact that he became a two-time winner, because the first win that he had was in a year that just was, Mike, let's be real, very few people like to go back and reflect and look back on the 1973 Indy 500, because it was a year that just seemed star-crossed from the very, very beginning.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, 73 was an utter disaster from the beginning to end, and it was just, you know, so many negative things happened, and so it is gratifying that Gordy was able to win a second 500 and win it in the way he did win it. You know, it was such a positive victory, exciting victory, one of the greatest finishes of all time. So went the full 500 miles. And so, you know, it was such a nice thing for Gordy to get a second win. That was such a positive victory for him.
Gordon Johncock, excuse me, was part of the 1965 rookie class at the Indianapolis 500 mile race. And 1973 was a rain-shortened race. It was marred by all kinds of tragedy and weather and all kinds of ugly events. But Gordon Johncock led the race late. Matter of fact, he was leading on lap 120-ish. Here's Gordon Johncock leading the race.
Now we have 120 laps with Gordon Johncock in car number 20 still holding on to first place, and number 2, Bill Vukovich, in second. Next time Gordy comes by, let's follow him around just to see if our fellas on the turns can have any observations that might be at all unique about the way he's driving the race. How much can one describe about a car going by? But our fellas do a pretty sensational job. There he is. Mike? Mike, can you pick up Gordy John caught number 20?
Okay, Sid, he just went by here, driving very smoothly in the groove. And perhaps as important as those 20-some seconds between he and the number two car, Billy Vukovic, and the fact he's got traffic in between him, six or seven cars. So that could be a difficult fight for Vukovic to get through all of that. All right, Sid.
As we mentioned, there were all kinds of things that took place over the course of the 1973 Indianapolis 500, which were not necessarily memorable. But the race was eventually called with Gordon Johncock in the lead, meaning that made him the winner. Even Sid Collins, the voice of the Indianapolis 500, was glad it was over.
And Andy Granatelli, it looks like, gosh, this couldn't happen again. I couldn't lose now, could I? As has happened in the past to him. I think the race is called now. Harlan Fengler, chief steward, says it is the end of the race. So there's something else new this time, Don, you can put in the file. We had the end of the race and no checkered flag was even waved. No checkered flag was actually waved. I did see Pat Vidan reach out and take his black and white checkered umbrella and put it up, but he just carries that anyway. Yes, John?
And Mike, even though it was a rain-shortened race that made Gordon Johncock a winner for the first time in Indianapolis, the reality is that Johncock was a deserving winner.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was up there all day and leading and one of the dominant cars. And so it's not one of those fluky situations where, you know, he happened to be leading at the only lap he led was the lap that they called the race. I mean, Gordon Johncock was an absolutely deserving winner to win the race that year. But, I mean, it was such a tragedy because obviously his teammate Swede Savage was critically injured and would later pass away. And a member of the Andy Granatelli team that, you know, he was the Pat Patrick team rather that he was on and Andy Granatelli sponsored with STP, you know, Armando Turan was fatally injured on pit lane when the Swede Savage accident happened. He was run over by a fire truck. So it was just tragic all around.
But Gordon Johncock, in terms of that win itself, did talk about the fact that he was somebody who earned the victory.
It didn't really make a lot of difference to me. I guess it was good to have it over with because of everything that had happened and all the rain and the delays. And I guess it was good to have it over with instead of continuing on. Who knows how much longer it would have taken to be able to run the race. I know it was only 133 laps or something like that, but I think we had led 70-some laps out of the race, out of what had been run. And so, you know, I felt myself that we earned the race. It wasn't a situation where, you know, we were running 10th, 15th, or whatever, and they stopped the race to rain. And then they called it, and you win the race. You know, we had been running good laps and leading the race.
Mike had mentioned the fact that there was this kind of haze over the victory itself after the race. As a matter of fact, the team immediately went to Methodist Hospital to visit the aforementioned Swede Savage, who was critically injured in the race and would pass away about a month later. But with all the delays and everything going on, there was no victory banquet. Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson on the sad circumstances that followed after the race was called.
His teammate was Swede Savage, who was very seriously injured and would later pass away. All the team went down to Methodist Hospital to see him, and then when they came out of there, it was at night and it was raining again. And they realized, wait a minute, you know, we haven't eaten today. We're hungry. And they went, it's never really been, the story keeps changing, but they stopped at a fast food place on 16th Street somewhere. And I'm not sure if that was Burger Chef at the time or if it was a little place called Burger and Steak, I think is what it might have been. But anyway, they did stop and have fast food at night. And so that, and then as the summer wore on, because it was such a horrible year, he basically, you know, he got the money, but really not very much credit. And I remember talking with him at the time, and then it would be like August. And then they started to get, people would call, and they'd get letters and cards. And it was like 3 months later, the people started to say, you know what? you did win it. Your face is on the going to be on the BorgWarner trophy. So, you know, it's been a while, but congratulations.
Gordon Johncock says it didn't bother him necessarily to not have a victory banquet after that 73 race.
I never was one that was into that, making appearances and all that. And it didn't really bother me because, you know, we didn't have a victory banquet and stuff like that.
Mike, as you had mentioned, Swede Savage, unfortunately, would ultimately pass from his injuries. And that really had an impact, I think, on Gordon Johncock, did it not? And the way that Johncock interacted with competitors and teammates moving forward.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned earlier on about how Bob Gordon Johncock doesn't come back very often to the speedway and things like that. Is, you know, he didn't get very close to the other drivers. He wasn't one of those people who, you know, he had a best friend. You know, Mario Andretti was famous for having best friends. Bobby Unser was a close friend. Billy Foster was a close friend, you know, things like that. And Gordon Johncock really didn't get very close to the other drivers. In fact, he had a famous feud with Johnny Rutherford at one point where they were really going at it pretty heavily. So, you know, he didn't really get very close to the other drivers.
I never really got close to the drivers because I didn't know if something like that, you know, would affect me and affect my ability to be driving. I just never got that close. But you surely think about it, but you know, if you're not really close to somebody, it is, I don't think it bothers you as much as it would if you were buddy buddies every day and talking, you know. But it wasn't good.
Ultimately, victory would come again for Gordon Johncock, but there were also years where he was part of a duel that led to another famous victory. We'll get into all of that as we continue to look back on his career on this episode of Beyond the Bricks.
In construction, every decision counts, but juggling multiple platforms, that just slows you down. BuilderTrend is the leading construction management platform built to help home builders lead their business with precision, where everything works in perfect alignment. Operations, financials, and materials all manage in one place. No more chaos, no more guesswork, just total control. Feel the night and day difference. Learn more at BuilderTrend.com/no more chaos.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Different races, different cars, different drivers, but the same result, victory. As Gordon Johncock and Richard Petty win back-to-back at Indian Daytona. Both fought friction and wear with STP oil treatment. Both fought harmful sludge and abrasives with the STP double oil filter. And that's a winning combination in anybody's engine, including yours.
That commercial from 1973, STP, Richard Petty, and the man that we're talking about tonight, Gordon Johncock. Jake Query, Mike Thompson here. Landon Coons putting it all together for us on this episode of Beyond the Bricks. Mike, we talked about the fact that Gordon Johncock won that race back in 1973, but 4 years later in 1977, the second 500 win for Gordon Johncock was within his grasp. We will always remember that race for the fact that A.J. Foyt would become the guy to win his fourth Indy 500, but Gordon Johncock had it within contention for the better part of that race.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Gordon Johncock was the guy to beat, I think, that day, you know, and then circumstances took it away from him. And one of the unfortunate things, Gordon Johncock was really overcome by heat in the second half of that race. His crew was actually taking buckets of water and just dumping it on him in the cockpit and pouring it on him. And actually, when Gordon drops out of the race, he went down into the creek to try to cool off a little bit, because that's how much the heat was really kind of affecting Gordon Johncock in the second half of the 77 race.
Here's how it sounded when Gordon Johncock dropped out of that race in 1977.
So the chase is on, but Gordon Johncock has pulled over to the left side of the straightaway. He appears to be slowing. He has cut his car in off of the apron at the south end of the main straightaway. A.J. Foyt is now our leader. There is apparently something wrong in Gordon Johncock's car. We see the... We see Gordon Johncock climbing out of his machine at the moment on the grass that used to be Victory Lane here at Indianapolis. It is not Victory Lane for Gordon Johncock.
As we mentioned, A.J. Foyt would go on to win the 1977 Indy 500, his fourth victory. That would make him the first four-time winner. He did a couple of things after winning that race. First, of course, famously, he took the victory lap in the pace car with Tony Holman. Another that he did afterwards was talking about chasing down Gordon Johncock.
You know, in 75, we should have won 76, but we run out of fuel twice. 77, we run out of fuel, and we got 32 seconds down, and we knew we were faster than McNaughty, and my chief mechanic, Jack Storms, which he still works for me in Houston, he says, I said, they'll let us get within 10 seconds, and then they'll turn the boost up, and I'll turn my boost up. That time, you could run whatever boost, but I didn't want to take a chance of breaking a motor before I got close to him. It went 10, 8, 9, you know, I was catching him on 2 seconds left. Jack said, if you turn the boost up, I said, no. I said, they got to be in trouble. And then he blew up because I knew Big Naughty, knowing the way I raced, he wasn't going to let me get within 10 seconds of him. And because I kind of knew how he operated before when I'd be way out in lead. He said, back off, back off. And then, all right, start picking it up. And that's where we worked good together. And that's the reason I said to Jack, which catched him pretty quick. I said, and they let me get about 10 seconds. Then he'll send Gordy. Well, I guess he was in trouble before that. I did not know that. And Jack done thought I turned the boost up. I said, no, I'm still running the same boot. I said, they got to be in trouble. You know what I mean?
So, absolutely.
And then it come apart. The motor did.
You know, another common thread, Mike, between A.J. Foyt and Gordon Johncock is both of them had the pleasure and the benefit of working with a guy that was as good at any when it came to working as a mechanic on those cars in that era of the Indy 500.
That's right. Both of them had considerable success working with the great George McNaughty. I mean, George McNaughty, I think, sometimes gets overlooked, as weird as that might sound, of how great he was. And so I had the opportunity actually to talk to A.J. Foyt in that last clip about, you know, his chasing down Gordon Johncock in 1977. And I had a chance to talk to Gordon Johncock about working with George McNaughty.
Gordon Johncock on that exact topic.
Yeah, we had a good relationship, you know. I wasn't one to tell the mechanics what to do to the car. I would tell them what the car, how the car was performing, and, you know, pushing loose or whatever. I would tell them, and they would make the adjustments. And, you know, kind of in that way, you didn't have no arguments back and forth what to do. They knew the adjustments to make, and I drove the car. And I think that it's a lot better relationship than somebody that really, a driver that really knows how or tries to tell them what to put in the car, what half springs or shocks or something.
You had mentioned Andy Granatelli earlier, Mike, and of course Andy Granatelli is so synonymous with STP. Same can be said, would you agree, Mike, for Gordon Johncock?
Oh, absolutely. He won both of his Indianapolis 500s driving for STP. He had a great relationship with that company. And one thing that we might overlook a little bit is, you know, he had several starts in NASCAR, and he drove a car actually sponsored by Pylon Wiper Blades, which was a division of STP at the time. And in the 1973 Firecracker 400, Gordon Johncock finished fourth, and the top four finishers were David Pearson, Richard Petty, Buddy Baker, Gordon Johncock. I mean, that's some heavy hitter names at the top of that order. So Gordon Johncock had a great relationship with STP.
Yes, you know, I had a good relationship with STP. You know, they were a good sponsor and treated me well. And I guess one thing I liked about it is I didn't have to make a lot of appearances. Richard Petty was also sponsored by STP, and they had him do most of that. He was well known, better so than me, and they had Richard Petty doing a lot of the appearances, and I didn't really have to do that kind of stuff. I like to run the race, get in my car and drive home, or fly one or the other. I had other businesses and go to work at home.
Mike, we talked about the fact that, and I have talked with Gordon Johncock, I know you have as well, about the fact that it was only fitting that he eventually would get that second win, partially just so that the 1973 win was not the one, you know, for a guy that was such a great driver, to have just that race that so many people would want to forget as your only win almost seems like it would have been unjust. And that took care of itself, as the racing gods often do. When the Indianapolis Motor Speedway selected Gordon Johncock as her winner in 1982. And I believe, Mike, it is my belief. Now, 1992 comes into play as well, but I personally believe that the 82 finish was probably the greatest lap shootout finish in the history of the radio network announcing the Indianapolis 500.
Oh, I agree 100%. I think 82 is the greatest finish, and I also think 82 is the greatest radio call. And 92 is a great radio call as well. So, I mean, they're very, very close, but 82 is a great, great radio call.
Radio, television, no matter what it was a fabulous finish, the 1982 Indianapolis 500.
And Mears is right there.
Like the start of this race. Johncock, then Mears, they're in turn two.
Now Gordy pulls away a little bit as Mears gets a little squirrely in turn number two. They're on the back stretch. It's still Gordon Johncock. Mears is trying, but he's about 10 car lengths behind as they streak down this 5/8 of a mile back stretch to turn three.
Less than half a lap ago. Gordy Johncock by 5 car lengths over Rick Mears. They're in the north short shoot.
Here they come. This is the final quarter lap. Johncock maintains the lead. The voice of the 500, Paul Page.
Gordon Johncock, his thoughts on winning that race, the 1982 Indianapolis 500.
Well, I guess I have to say when I won the last race, 82, when I beat Rick, experience really took effect. And when I think when more pressure was put on me, when I was driving the better I did, and the way I had to drive that last lap down on the apron, my car was pushing so bad that if I'd have had to get out of the throttle coming out of the corners, Rick would have went by me, and I had to get way down on the bottom, and that kind of helped make the rear end a little bit loose. And I got so low in turn three, I'd never run down that low before. Rick even thought I was going to lose the car. It got jumped out with me, the back end, but was able to save it and go on to win.
Mike, we talked the other day in starting and resuming again Beyond the Bricks in anticipation of the Brickyard 400 about the fact that this past May was difficult for you because you had the race itself, which was a rain race, and even though it went 200 laps, and then you lost your mother shortly after, and the reality is that for Gordon Johncock, even though there was a celebration of winning the 1982 race, it also was one that once again, he had to be heavy-hearted after the fact that he had won that race in 1982.
That's right. And it's really, really sad because, you know, we talked in the last segment about the fact he didn't get a victory banquet in 1973. And then in 82, the victory banquet was basically overshadowed and made to be basically a somber affair for Gordon Johncock because he lost his mom. And Donald in this next clip, it's a very poignant soundbite talking about how somber the whole situation was. And so you really have to feel for Gordon Johncock about the fact that, you know, these two triumphs, you know, what should be two of the greatest days of his life, you know, they were both really ended up being both pretty somber affairs for Gordon Johncock.
There is a downside, which most people don't know, that there's this terribly cruel fate. Johncock's mother was very sick. And maybe you don't know this. Johncock's mother was very sick. And after the race, he flew on the Patrick plane. They flew him back up so he could see his mother, who was very ill. And then they left and came back down. And I don't know whether they came that night or the next morning, but they had the day after shots. So they did the day after shots. They go to the victory banquet. And he told me, he said, as we walked in the door to get home after the victory banquet, the phone was ringing. And it was somebody to tell me that my mother had passed away. And he tears up talking about it then and now. And I think, what a cruel twist of fate. And, you know, you lose your mother, but of all times, your greatest moment just got destroyed. And so, you know, hate to throw cold water on the thing, but, that you know, that stayed with me. There was a downside that most the general public never knew.
Gordon Johncock, he would still have great stories that could be told about him, including how he ventured into retirement and Donald Davidson's favorite recollection of the man from Michigan. We'll talk about that when we come back to Beyond the Breaks.
This is the Bet365 Command Center. Get your race updates here all month long and make sure to enter for your chance to win $500 by predicting the winner of this year's race on July 27th. Go to 1075thefan.com to enter. Now, here's your 2025 race update brought to you by Bet365.
Your race update. We will give you a schedule update for what is going to be taking place this weekend at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. On Saturday, gates open at 11 o'clock in the morning. That is just 2 hours before the qualifying gets underway for the Xfinity cars in anticipation of the Pennzoil 250. Then at 2:35, the NASCAR Cup qualifying takes place. That will be a 55-minute affair, concluding at 3:30 in the afternoon. At 4:30 on Saturday, it is the Pennzoil 250, which those Xfinity cars always put on a good show at 16th and Georgetown. Again, 4:30 on Saturday. Then Sunday, 2 o'clock, it is the running of the NASCAR Cup Brickyard 400 at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Miller Lite, la cerveza light legendaria. Si pudiera hablar, contaría historias. Y si la has probado, probablemente tienes historias que contar. Por otros 50 años de Miller Time. Celebra responsablemente. 2025 Miller Brewing Co., Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Landon Coons putting it all together for us. The Bet365 Command Center is where we are for Beyond the Bricks. And, of course, Quality Supply and Tool helping make it all possible. We appreciate that greatly. As we talk about those personalities in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, again, you just heard me mention, Saturday at 11 o'clock, the gates will be open. It'll be qualifying day at IMS. 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the Xfinity cars will qualify. Then at 2:35, Cup cars will qualify before the 4:30 running of the Pennzoil 250. Those Xfinity cars, like I mentioned, always put on a good show at IMS. Then 2 o'clock, it is on Sunday, the Brickyard 400 that will run. Of those drivers in the history of racing that have run both Cup cars and Indy cars, Gordon Johncock, one of them, that is the subject of our discussion today. And Mike, one of the things that I think is interesting when you talk about Gordon Johncock or any of his contemporaries and competitors of that era is the fact that when you think about Johncock, Rutherford, the Unsers, Mario, Emerson Fittipaldi, Rick Mears, so many of those drivers, obviously, as they were competitors with one another, their retirements seemingly came within about a 5 to 7 year window of one another, which led to a complete changing of the guard of the stars of IndyCar racing in the Indianapolis 500. But Gordon Johncock was one of those that was kind of the first to start to see that light coming through the tunnel of the fact that it was time to go on and advance into another career. But his retirement came really when, to use a racing term, seemingly there was still some fuel in the tank.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, his first retirement was a huge shock to everybody when he decided to retire the first time. It was just in the middle of the week and right before qualifying, and he just decided, you know, yep, that's it. I'm going to retire. And he was still basically at the top of his game. You know, he had run the full 84 season, and all of a sudden in 85 he retired, and then had second thoughts and decided to come out of retirement. But it really was interesting, the fact that he just, you know, he decided in 85, you know, I'm done, and that's it.
You know, one of the things I think that this kind of shows about John Cock, and it's disingenuous for me to say that I know Gordon John Cock well. You know, I think we always have within our job, and we probably, or at least I should clarify for folks, it is true that we have a unique access to the drivers, both of past and present, of the Indianapolis 500 or IndyCar racing in general. And it gives you glimpse and perspective into sometimes what motivates, what drives, pardon the pun, these drivers that we get so much enjoyment in watching. But it doesn't mean that we're necessarily involved in the day-to-day in seeing who and what they are. But we get glimpse of it. And one thing about Gordon John Cock that I have always respected in the little glimpses that I've been able to see behind the curtain, Mike, is he is a guy who certainly is very confident and comfortable in who he is, and at the same time is very confident in making the decisions that are best for Gordon John Cock and not necessarily always falling in line with, and I don't mean that in a rebellious sense, but somebody who is going to do what he wants to do as opposed to conforming to what is always kind of the norm within the boundaries of his profession, if that makes sense what I'm saying.
No, that's right. I mean, Gordon John Cock is his own man. It's interesting because he, during his racing career at one point, he moved to Arizona, and he lived in Arizona and had a ranch and was kind of doing some ranching and things like that. And that was kind of a passion of his for a while. And then he honestly kind of got tired of it and didn't like the ranching anymore and decided to move back to Michigan, which is, you know, where he's from originally. He's from a town in called Hastings, Michigan, by Coldwater, where also Scotty Brayton was from Coldwater, Michigan. And it's interesting because then he got so interested in this lumber mill, the sawmill that he bought. And as you said, he's still doing the sawmill every day. You know, I called up there and spoke to his wife a couple times, and I wanted to speak to Gordy, and she said, yeah, he's at the sawmill. And you're thinking, you know, Gordon John Cock's at the sawmill every day still. I mean, he just likes doing it and he enjoys it. And like you said, this is the passion and this is what he's interested in doing now. So he's a person who he's going to do his own thing. And as you said, he's a nonconformist in that he's going to, what Gordon John Cock wants to do is what he's going to do.
And in 1985, what that was that he wanted to do, as Mike had mentioned, while still essentially in the middle of his game, the surprising announcement that he would retire, and of course it would end up being for the first time, Donald Davidson on Gordon John Cock's first retirement.
And he practiced, and on the night before the day before the first qualifying day, he announced that he was retiring. And it was kind of stunning, really, because it just seemed to come out of nowhere. But in fact, he actually came on this program that evening, on the Friday evening, and to say that he was done. And I said, you know, you might rethink this. And he said, no, I'm happy with the decision, and I'm done. Well, he soon regretted it. But anyway, so he did not run in the race. And they hired Don Whittington to qualify the car. And then Gordy was a driver expert along with Roger Wood for the race. Well, during the winter, he rethought it and decided he wanted to come back. But he assumed Patrick would take him back. But they said, no, we're not going to be doing it with Gordy anymore.
John Cock would come back and race again. And as a matter of fact, would do so, and in some variations, in some spots, do so really well and with great note, as a matter of fact. Gordon Johncock's career would, in his return, show the same form that made Gordon Johncock not just a two-time winner of the Indy 500, but a racing legend in general. Also, in coming back, it led to one of our Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson's favorite stories about the two-time winner, Gordon Johncock.
Ron Hemelgarn and Jonathan Bird were partners. Stan Fox was the main driver. They also had Buddy Lazier in a car, and they had this third car. Well, Jonathan Bird thought, let's aim for the top. And 91 was a year that Al Unser didn't have a ride. And he was holding out for something special, and Jonathan Bird took him to dinner and said, drive for us. Well, Al didn't really want to do it because it was a Cosworth. Well, they then, at the same time, they were talking to Johnny Rutherford. Johnny Rutherford didn't want to take it. And Johnny Rutherford, at that time, he wasn't doing the pace car thing, but he was doing the radio broadcast. And so I said, why wouldn't you take the car? He said, I don't want to drive it. It's a Cosworth. And I said, but Johnny, you had 24 starts, and now there's been some years when you didn't make it, and I know that 25 was very important to you. You could make the start. And he said, I don't want to be in it unless I can win. So okay. So then the next thing I remember hearing, Johncock's going to drive it. I said, Johncock, he hasn't run for a while. Well, Ron Hemelgarn really liked Johncock from previous years, so he called him, and Johncock was on his tractor when the phone rang, and I don't know if he knew that the phone rang or he had it with him or the wife went out and got him. But anyway, so he gets off the tractor, and he says, come down and drive this car. So down Gordy comes, and makes the show, qualifies 33rd, outside the last row. So then the next thing that happened was we come to the track on race morning, or was it even the day before, we heard Johncock has got the flu. We don't know if he can drive. I'm not sure if I knew that the day before or when we came in that morning, but anyway, they had Johnny Parsons on standby. And Parsons was either going to be a relief driver or even start the race mm-hmm. if Johncock couldn't do it. So they gave him some medication, and I saw Parsons later, and he was dressed. And I said, what happened? He said, he said, Gordy will be okay. He said, I didn't even bother to put my uniform on when I saw him. Well, then, so race starts, a lot of attrition. And during the course of the race, I kept needling Johnny off the air every time because he's in the booth next to me. And I said, hey, John, you're 16th. And he would just shrug and go, hey, John, you're 13th. Well, in the late stages of the race, Johncock comes into the top 10. And this was the year that Mario was running, golly, I don't know, third, fourth, fifth, something like that. And he dropped out late and pulled off into the pits and could have come on in, but stuck himself in such a position where he was trying to help Michael, mm-hmm. who was in a big battle with Rick Mears. So anyway, be that as it may, Mario was out of the race, and so his lap count is going to remain the same, and I spend half the race or more looking at the monitor, and I'm looking at Johncock's lap count, and I figured, you know what? I think Johncock, who is now seventh, can get sixth. And sure enough, late race screen, off they go, and then Johncock takes the white flag, and he's seventh. And then out comes the checker, and everybody's coming by, and I'm looking, and sure enough, blip, Mario, that was sitting sixth without, gets bumped to seventh, and Johncock gets sixth. So I said to Johnny, you finished sixth. And for the first time, he'd been poo-pooing all along. He looks at it, the monitor, and he goes, that's the first time that it really dawned on him that could have been me. I could have been in my 25th 500 and finished sixth. But
of course, that day, Gordon Johncock, and a couple of notes from that as Donald Davidson reflecting on that 1991 race. That 91 race had a bevy of former winners in it. Obviously, A.J. Foyt, Bobby Rahal was in that race, Emerson Fittipaldi, Danny Sullivan, Mario Andretti, Gordon Johncock, Ari Leyendijk, and Rick Mears. And Gordon Johncock, as we had mentioned, Mike, earlier in the show, the one time that I was able to spend any time at all around Gordon Johncock after his racing career and away from a racetrack, one of the things that was brought up was that 1991 race. And Johncock, for somebody who doesn't talk a lot about his career as a race car driver, and, you know, even in his home, there is very little there that would tell you that he was a race car driver. He has his baby Borgs displayed and a fabulous portrait of the 82 finish displayed within his home, but it doesn't have the large trophy cases and photo displays that a lot of people would have, rightly so, to reflect on their career. But one of the things in talking to Gordon Johncock that I could tell was the race that he genuinely enjoyed talking about when I brought it up was that 1991 race, because that had been my senior year of high school. I reflect on that race very fondly. You had the epic shootout that Donald mentioned there between Michael Andretti and Rick Mears late in the race. And I got the impression that as much as his two wins at Indianapolis, that Gordon Johncock was as happy about that top 10 finish and that 1991 race almost as anything that he could be proud about during the course of his racing career.
Oh, I believe that, especially, you know, when you step away from the game and then you come back and you know, he hadn't run the 500 again for a couple of years. And, you know, I think that had to have been extremely satisfying to grab that sixth place finish. And you know, that was his, you know, next to last Indianapolis 500 and his next to last championship start. So that had to be pretty satisfying, I think.
When you look back at your time in watching racing, Mike, you know, there are a lot of drivers that you had as favorites or drivers maybe that you even saw in person or drivers that your uncle or your dad or, you know, others have told you about that was their favorite. Johncock's an interesting one because, you know, I think you meet a lot of people that they loved Mario or they loved Al Unser or Bobby Unser or whatever it might be. And then they have drivers that they say, but I rooted against that guy. You never really hear either of those things about Gordon Johncock. And I mean that not as a bad thing, but I don't know that anybody necessarily that you meet says my favorite driver was Gordon Johncock. But at the same time, you don't really meet anybody who rooted against him. He was a very likable driver.
Yeah, and it's funny because I've heard a couple of times, you know, people really want him to come back and do one of the, you know, the autograph sessions, you know, that they have on Legends Day or that we have out at the memorabilia show. And I had heard a couple of times that Gordon Johncock had said something to the effect like, well, you know, nobody wants to see me. They only want to see, you know, Mario, or they only want to see AJ or something like that. And I think that's really not the case. I think people really want to see Gordon Johncock because A, he hasn't been around in a long time. And B, I think he's a lot more popular than maybe he thinks he is. I actually, at the memorabilia show, I get asked a lot of times for Gordon Johncock stuff. Do you have any Gordon Johncock patches or any photographs and stuff like that? So I actually think he has still to this day a bigger fan base than he might think he has. I think he was a very popular driver. And I think part of that is the no nonsense. You know, he was a racer's racer, no nonsense, didn't do a, you know, wasn't flashy, just like you said at the beginning of the show, put his foot down on the floor. And I think people respected him and still respect him to this day for that.
He certainly is connected to plenty of stories of greatness, you know, overcoming tragedy and turning it into triumph, getting the opportunity to take advantage of it and become a two-time winner. And that 73 race, you know, that's one of the things that he talks about, as we heard, is that it was just that he would win that 82 race after winning in 1973, that race that had so much sadness with it. We appreciate you listening tonight to Beyond the Bricks.